I'm Heather Goldstone, and this is Living Lab on The Point. The federal law that mandates fishery management includes 10 national standards that all fishing regulations must meet. But those standards are somewhat vague, and they're sometimes even contradictory. They set managers the difficult task of protecting fish stocks while simultaneously preserving fishing communities. They're also supposed to ensure that fishing rights are distributed fairly and equitably. Not surprisingly, new regulations are often criticized for failing to give due weight to one of these competing demands. Recently, there's been talk of the need for a cohesive vision, a statement of shared values and priorities to more explicitly guide managers as they craft the regulations that shape the future of the fishing industry. Later this hour, we'll explore some of the ideas being discussed here in New England about the importance of maintaining a diverse fishing fleet, and we'll talk about the different definitions of that word diverse. Also, the question of whether fishery managers should get involved in the issue of where fish goes after it's landed. Such visioning efforts are in their infancy in New England, so first, let's turn to a region that's already well into its visioning process. In 2011, the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council launched a visioning and strategic planning project with the largest stakeholder engagement initiative in its history. More than 1,500 stakeholders weighed in through online surveys, small group meetings, and position letters. That information was boiled down to statements of vision and mission that are the foundation for the 10-year strategic plan that the council is in the process of creating now. Rick Robbins was appointed to the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council in 2007 and has served as chairman since 2008. He owns a whelk processing business on Virginia's eastern shore and exports seafood in conjunction with Chesapeake Bay Packing in Newport News, Virginia. He joins us now by phone. Rick Robbins, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning, Heather, and thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Now, Rick, can you take us back a couple years or probably even a few years before this actually started in 2011? What was the impetus for the visioning process that the Mid-Atlantic Council is going through?
Yeah, we actually have to go back about 3 years, Heather. That's right. And so the background was that we were at an important inflection point, essentially, in our council's history. We had been through a very difficult chapter in rebuilding our managed stocks, and that had been a very long and hard process. I think everybody in the region is familiar with that. We had been through that, and that process essentially was top-down. It was characterized, I think, as reactive. In other words, council actions were dominated by reactions to news that a fish stock might have been in a depleted state, and then we had to react and rebuild those stocks. And frankly, over a long period of time, we had to simultaneously rebuild a number of our managed species, and so the ultimate effect with our stakeholders was that it was somewhat alienating. The council was complying with the law, was doing what it had to do. We made a lot of hard decisions, and previous councils before I was on had to make hard decisions about how to set quotas. They did that, but at the end of the day, a lot of stakeholders were somewhat disenfranchised. They felt disaffected. I think it left a lingering sense of cynicism with a lot of fishermen about their willingness to participate in the process. They felt like their input might not have had that much impact on the outcomes. But again, the council was constrained during that period. So we were at this important inflection point. We wanted to shift towards being more proactive because we had attained a lot of the goals that were initially set out before us to end overfishing, to rebuild these stocks. But we needed to think through what success would look like in the future once the stocks were rebuilt. And we were also trying to come to terms with the national catch share policy that came out about the same time, and we had a workshop on that to consider catch share models and experiences from around the world. And one of the conclusions that we drew from those discussions was the fact that no matter what type of management model you have for a fishery, it's critically important to have well-established goals and objectives. And so we took that up to another level and talked about trying to have a vision for Mid-Atlantic fisheries and then going from there in terms of whatever management actions we might take. And the council agreed to that. It took 3 years for us to go through this process. The first two were devoted to the visioning work, which was basically data collection and interaction with stakeholders. And then we spent a year on the strategic planning process.
So who has been involved in this? I mean, 1,500 stakeholders. Who are those stakeholders?
Well, the stakeholders are broad. So they're stakeholders in Mid-Atlantic fisheries, including commercial interest, recreational interest, environmental NGOs, and the general public. And we use several different models to get the input from stakeholders. And we've kept our advisors very close throughout this process. We put together advisory panels and steering committees and working groups to do all the work. But early on, we engage our stakeholders and ask them, what is the most effective way to get information from your constituencies. And that's how we started building the process. And so we got specific input, and we had, you know, a straw man approach that we developed internally initially. We vetted that through our APs and our advisory groups, and they substantially changed those methods. And so what we ended up with was something that was informed by our constituents about how to best interact with them and get the information. And so we used different methods with different groups. With the commercial fisheries, for example, we had port meetings, we had face-to-face small group meetings, and those were usually done on a peer-to-peer basis. So we would partner with the local co-host. So we would find a leader in the fishing industry in a certain port. They would then reach out to their peers and invite them to come to the meeting. And that really helped get people into the process that otherwise wouldn't have participated. And I think, you know, in using that method, we got a lot of input that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
You mentioned that you were starting from a point where many of your stakeholders were already somewhat disenfranchised or cynical. Was there a hurdle to get over to actually get buy-in and involvement from those stakeholders in this visioning process?
Well, I think there was. And again, you know, some of the tools we used helped do that. In other words, we reached out personally to a lot of the leaders in the commercial industry in order to facilitate those meetings. And I think we were able to get off the ground by using that method. And part of it up front, I mean, we did have to communicate the fact that their input would make a difference, that their input would be used to develop a stakeholder-driven vision for the future as opposed to what we had done in the past, which was, again, being primarily in a reactive mode. We made it clear that we wanted to transition out of that. We wanted to be more proactive. We wanted to see what their concerns were within our managed fisheries, also what they saw as opportunities to make improvements in the management of our fisheries, and what their concerns were longer term and what they wanted to see for desired outcomes.
What about the general public? I mean, these are the people buying the fish and essentially supporting and then also benefiting from the fisheries. Are they considered a stakeholder, and were they involved in this process?
They are, and they were. And so their input came primarily through survey input. So we had a survey that was available on our website electronically, and we had over 1,500 responses to that. And that was the primary tool for reaching the public. But we also recognize that the geographic reach of our fisheries goes well beyond the mid-Atlantic. So a lot of fishermen in southern New England, for example, depend on the squid fishery, or they interact with the summer flounder fishery, mackerel, surf clams, other fisheries. So we spent a lot of time in southern New England as well. In fact, we had our first meeting in New Bedford. We started out in the mayor's office and participated in the Working Waterfront Festival that weekend, and that kicked off our visioning work. So we had a series of meetings that ranged throughout southern New England in the course of the data collection process, and we got a lot of important input from those groups, and there were a lot of similarities about their concerns that they were shared more widely throughout the Mid-Atlantic region, and they had their own unique concerns also about issues like representation on our council.
So 2 years, 1,500 stakeholders, it sounds like an immense amount of effort went into this. And if you look on the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council website, there's this single-sentence statement of visions: healthy and productive marine ecosystems supporting thriving, sustainable marine fisheries that provide the greatest overall benefit to stakeholders. Is that really the product of all of this effort? Is that one sentence?
Well, Heather, I think that's the 30,000-foot sentence that you get out of the process. So as we went through this, we went through a very deliberate process with a working group, and that working group ultimately developed a vision. But that's the overarching vision for our fisheries. As you come down below that, though, you end up with strategic objectives and goals, and those are much more finer scale in nature. And I think it's at that level that this plan gets operationalized. And what we'll end up doing is going through the strategic goals and each section of that, and then incorporating those goals and objectives into our annual work plan. So that would be the mechanism by which we would implement the vision and the strategic plan.
So give us a little bit more insight into that finer scale of the vision for the Mid-Atlantic Council. What is the vision? What are the priorities and the values for the Mid-Atlantic fishery region?
Well, we haven't gone through the prioritization process. That'll be part of the implementation step. But if you just take a look at some of the sections within the strategic goals, some relate to communication, and that's actually been a very significant component of the work that we've done. We've already done a number of things to implement improved communications within the council process, including overhauling the council website. We've made it easier for people to submit public comments. One of the things that I think we've really significantly changed is the way that we interact with stakeholders. We're doing it more proactively. So we're using new tools and methods that we didn't use before. We're relying more on workshops. If we have a specific topic that we really want to get detailed input from stakeholders on, and we're trying to do some of that out, you know, away from the regulatory process. In other words, have a specific workshop that's not simply a scoping hearing, but really provides an opportunity to get detailed input. We've done several of those. We did one with the recreational fishing public to really better understand the values and desired objectives for the recreational community, because we have very diverse recreational fisheries in our region. We have private boat anglers, we have pier anglers, we have charter party boat anglers, and they may have very different objectives and a diverse range of values, but we had a detailed workshop for that constituency. We've also had one for the squid fishery. We've done one recently for deep-sea corals, and that brought together deep-sea coral researchers, squid fishermen that would most likely be interacting with the regulatory side of that plan amendment. And we also use some interactive technologies to do GIS mapping.
So it sounds like a lot of what is in this vision is not so much a vision for the fishery or the fleets or the boats themselves, but a vision for how that end product is shaped. Is more a vision for the management process than it is for the fishery itself.
I think that's fair to a large degree. A lot of it is focused on the process by which we develop actions and also the way we interact with our stakeholders. And I think that represents hopefully a fundamental shift in how we do business. And so a lot of it is process-oriented, but within the strategic goals, there are a lot of issues related to coordination. For example, there's no way we can attain some of the elements of the strategic goals by ourselves. We have to work closely with the Science Center. We have to work more broadly with the scientific community and management partners in order to achieve the strategic goals. So there are a number of areas in there where collaboration is highlighted.
How different or overlapping, compatible are your now regional goals compared to the national standards that are set by Magnuson-Stevens, the Federal Fishery Regulation Act?
Well, Heather, I think they're largely compatible with a couple of exceptions. And so if you look at our mission that's part of the strategic plan, it says the council manages marine fisheries in federal waters of the Mid-Atlantic region for their long-term sustainability and productivity consistent with the national standards of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. So the council's mission is essentially captured largely in the Magnuson Act. You know, we have supplemented that with some of this language, but it's largely embraced in the standards. And yet there are a couple of issues. I mean, if you think about how could we transition to ecosystem-based management, which is something that we've been working on, there may be some internal inconsistencies within the Act that need to be resolved. For example, it may be necessary from time to time to fish one species at a level above what we call MSY, or maximum sustainable yield. It may also be necessary to fish some species well below that in order to achieve specific ecological objectives within the context of an ecosystem-type plan. And so some of those internal inconsistencies should probably be clarified within the Act if we're truly going to implement ecosystem-based management. Another relates to representation, just thinking about southern New England. When we met with fishermen in Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts, they all raised some concerns about the fact that their jurisdictions weren't represented on our council. And so we've been exploring ways that we might incorporate those concerns. I've tried to convene as a committee of the whole whenever possible so that the New England representatives that are on our committees could vote. But ultimately, the council has to submit the action to the secretary. So even if we convene as a committee of the whole, the council still has to submit the final action. And so we think one way to resolve that would be to allow the liaisons to vote on both councils, because New England has interest in our fisheries, and we similarly have some fisheries that we're not able to vote all the way through the process on, like the sea scallop fishery, which is our top value fishery in the Mid-Atlantic.
Now, obviously, you're still in this process. The strategic plan for the coming decade or the coming 5 years has not been finalized yet. But I wonder if you've already seen an impact of this visioning process in your management process. Are there examples where you think there's a decision that's been made that might have gone differently before this visioning process began?
Heather, we have. And so I said, a lot of what this is about is how we interact with our stakeholders and also respond to their concerns and take things up more proactively. And so one thing that we did just recently was to overhaul the recreational accountability measures that we have in place to manage our recreational fisheries. And as we went through this process, one of the overarching concerns that was very apparent among our recreational stakeholders was the fact that they had concerns about the quality of the recreational catch estimates, and not only the quality of the estimates, but then how those are used in management. And so and we can't change the quality of those estimates internally. I mean, that's not a council operation. We don't collect the data. We obviously work with our management partners to prioritize data needs, but we don't run that program. But we are responsible for how we use that data. And so we just completely overhauled our recreational accountability measures, and that was responsive to the input that we got through the vision process. So I think that's one good example of that. We've also had workshops that were specific to the management of forage species and concerns about lower trophic level fisheries and how species interactions are considered in management was something that was broadly important to our constituents. So that's something that's also been responsive. We're initiating a ecosystem approach to fisheries management guidance document that's also responsive to that input. And then from a process standpoint, we've also made other changes. So I think we've done a lot of things already that reflect that input. We've also supported potentially a certification program, but I think the better way to characterize that is that what we ultimately need is a relatively simple solution, but one that results in an affirmation of the sustainability of fisheries caught under the Magnuson Act that processors and fishermen can use to market their products.
So this strategic plan that you're finalizing at this point is for the next several years. When that strategic plan has lived out its life, will you be going through this entire visioning process again in a few years?
Heather, that hadn't been specified yet, but I would anticipate that this will essentially be a living document. And so I would think that it will be adaptive and continue to be responsive to the input that we get from the public. So we've got a set of goals and objectives. Over the course of the next 5 years, we'll be trying to implement those goals and objectives. And if there are emerging needs within our fisheries, we want to be responsive to that. So obviously, as those needs come up, we'll want to incorporate those into our annual priorities and work plans also.
Well, Rick Robbins, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Heather.
Rick Robbins is chairman of the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council. He spoke to us about the council's visioning and strategic planning project. We're talking this hour about efforts to craft a vision for the future of New England's fisheries, a document that could guide fishery managers as they construct regulations that impact who fishes, where and how they do their fishing, and what happens to fish after it's landed. Joining me is Brett Tolley, community organizer and policy advocate with the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. Brett comes from a four-generation Cape Cod fishing family and has himself worked in the fishing industry in a variety of roles. He holds a degree in international relations with a focus on social justice from Elon University, and describes himself as fiercely dedicated to protecting fishing communities and the ocean. Brett Tolley, welcome.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
Paul Parker is director of the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust. Paul earned a bachelor's in biology from Cornell University and a master's of environmental management from Duke University. He's held numerous jobs on Cape Cod commercial fishing vessels, and since 1997, he's been working with fishermen to restore both fish populations and fishing communities. The Cape Cod Fisheries Trust was founded by the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance, formerly the Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association. It was founded in 2005 to provide economic development initiatives in support of small-scale fishing businesses. Paul Parker, welcome.
Good morning, Heather. Thank you.
And finally, joining us by phone is Vito Giacalone. He's chair of governmental affairs and a member of the board of directors for the Northeast Seafood Coalition, as well as president of the Gloucester Fishing Community Preservation Fund. Giacalone is a third-generation commercial fisherman with 30 years of experience. He's the owner-operator of the fishing vessel Jenny G and owner of Fisherman's Wharf in Gloucester. He's been called Gloucester's best-known and connected leader. Vito Giacalone, welcome.
Thank you, Heather.
And, of course, we welcome you to join our conversation and share your vision for the future of New England's fisheries. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Brett, the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, the group that you work with, has actually launched its own fleet visioning project. Why does New England need a vision for its fishing fleet, and what are the key issues that a vision would need to address?
Sure. Well, the New England managers often get criticized for what we call the fire-ready-aim style of management. And as long as I can remember, you know, coming from a four-generation fishing family with my grandfather, memories being out in the boat with him and hearing his critique of the managers, it goes way back to, you know, the 80s. It was as far back as I can remember when the managers were having that same criticism. So for 20, 30 years, it's been a style of management where there has been no clear vision, yet these decisions being made that really impact fishing communities all over New England and, of course, the fish stocks themselves. So in 2006, NAMA began a fleet visioning project to engage stakeholders from throughout New England. It was a two-year process. About 250 people were involved in surveys and roundtable discussions to do what managers were failing to do, create a shared vision, identify some key values to help us move forward in a management style that we know would be more proactive rather than reactive.
So that's kind of echoing what Rick Robbins was saying about the Mid-Atlantic, mm-hmm. this trying to get out of this reactive mode. What actually came out of that visioning project? What are some of those shared values and key issues?
Sure. So the main, as Rick had said, the 30,000 view vision was a fleet that was economically viable, ecologically robust, a diverse fleet in terms of gear type, boat size, geographical location, and then a fleet that was governed in a bottom-up management style.
So bottom-up being coming from the fishermen, not coming down from the government.
Right. Both the fishermen and folks on the community level who are both involved in the fisheries and also may eat seafood.
Vito Giacalone, I wonder if you could weigh in here. The Northeast Seafood Coalition counts both small and large boats among its members, has a very diverse membership. It's one of the largest associations of ground fishing boats in New England. First of all, could you just define those terms, large and small boat, for us? What are we talking about in terms of scale here?
Well, in New England, right now, we're really looking at a fleet that's predominantly smaller vessels, smaller being under 50 foot. Roughly 80%, I believe, of the vessels in the region are under 50 foot. And what we call larger vessels right now would be anything between 60 and 95 feet. And there aren't very many of those left in the fishery right now, but certainly large in the ground fish fishery is not a vessel. There aren't any vessels that I'm aware of that are 100 foot or more. So these are, when you're talking about the distant waters of Georgia's Banks, they're relatively small vessels and still weather-dependent type vessels. But those are what we call large vessels in our fishery right now.
Do you think that there could be a single vision that would address the needs of all of New England's fishermen, all of these different sizes of boats, the different gear, the different geographic regions?
I do. I think it's actually been implemented. That's the issue is when I say implemented, Brett had just mentioned four very noble and goals that we embrace. The vessel size, a fleet of diverse vessel sizes, is something that the current sector system basically embraces and has that in place. Of course, it's trying to maintain at least at a minimum a static diversity of the fleet that we have right now. In other words, you've got to stabilize what you've got before you can figure out how to engineer it from there. But it is also a bottom-up managed or governed fishery right now. It's managed by the sectors, and the individual sector entities are all board of directors of the fishermen in those communities, the various vessel sizes and gear types that wanted to remain independent and be able to have their own management and governance with basically the Coalition and Cape Cod Hook and Associated Fisheries of Maine and others have put in place sectors that allow these sectors to operate independently and with the affinities that they share, while at the same time working together in a governance from bottom up where they interact with each other outside of the management process directly. And they can talk with each other about different issues that they feel that they can come to the table with collaboratively together for mutual benefit. And so that governance is in place as we speak. So the visioning that, you know, Brett talks about in 2006 was implemented through Amendment 16. Now, there are other issues that have caused great stresses on the fishery that we don't believe are the direct result of having a lack of vision and objectives. They're a lack of control of the allowable catches that come into the system and the costs of you know, at-sea monitoring and monitoring the fishery, as well as the limitations on the data that we have to work with to establish annual catch limits. So those are the things that are causing stresses on the fishery right now that are making any objective or vision that we have very difficult to attain.
Now, Paul Parker, we've heard a couple of times this mention of the catch share style of management, these sectors that Vito Giacalone has been describing. Could you clarify for us a little bit what that actual management structure is, how catch shares and sectors work, and is that a style of management that needs more of a vision than perhaps some of the previous ways that we've managed fisheries by just limiting days at sea or that kind of thing? Does this new management style necessitate more of a vision?
Well, we'll start off with a brief description of the catch shares, but essentially on an annual basis, the fisheries scientists assess the population of fish in the ocean and come up with a recommendation for an amount of quota, how much can be taken out of the ocean sustainably to maintain robust and growing fish stocks in the ocean for us to harvest in the future. And then that quota is divided out into shares that are awarded to fishermen throughout the fleet. And that's happened in portions of our clam fishery. It's happened in the scallop fishery for the smaller boats, as well as in the groundfish fishery through sectors.
And when you say awarded, how are those determinations made of who fishing rights are awarded to?
In all three of those fisheries, the allocations are based on historical participation. So the people that have caught more fish in the past, and in the instance of scallop, it was a five-year window. In the instance of surf clam and groundfish, it was both over the period of a decade. And those allocations are hotly contested and you know, continue to be debated today. And I think just going back to one of your previous questions, when we think about visioning, we strongly believe that the solutions to these problems can be created at the community level. And while we value the input of federal regulators and a regional process, it's just not possible for people at that scale to see what's needed in our community.
So do you think we need a regional vision, or is this, or should we just stick to essentially community level visions and work within the broader framework that already exists?
Well, I look at the case study that we've provided this morning, which is the Mid-Atlantic Fisheryman Management Council, and everything that Rick said could be attributed to New England, and yet the Mid-Atlantic is totally different than New England. So when you get to those 30,000-foot elevations that NAMA and the Mid-Atlantic created, they lose an element of applicability at the local level. And so I see value in it, and I see an importance in terms of guiding broad steerage of a regional body and giving them some advice about what's important regionally. But when it comes to building a solution that will promote fleet diversity, that's got to come from the ground up. And that's, you know, part and parcel to many of the valuable community-based solutions that are coming out of New England at this time.
Brett, I want to give you a chance to respond to this. I mean, we've essentially got Vito Giacalone and Paul Parker here saying that maybe we've done all the visioning that we need to, and we need to be working at implementing our values at a community level. Do we need to do further visioning at the regional level in New England and have that in some way incorporated into the council's structure or process in a more formal way?
Yes, I believe we have to do both. I think we need to engage the communities in developing a vision that is unique to the community. Every ecosystem throughout New England is very different. So we do need communities engaged in a very specific vision for what it means to be diverse in those communities. And I think at the same time, we need our regional managers to be developing a vision to at least give some accountability and at least set some standard for the various communities or the sectors to be accountable towards. Because I feel like otherwise there's no incentive for any given sector to work towards achieving a more diverse fleet. And what we're seeing play out right now in our sector management, our catch share management system in New England, is that there's a consolidation in the fleet happening. And if you look at the data, we're seeing that consolidation have a disproportionate squeeze on smaller scale, more independent fishers throughout New England. And the managers in New England have not set any standards or baselines to incentivize sectors to ensure that those segments of the fleet are not completely lost in this consolidation process.
So what we're talking about here is then those smaller boats are not, this comes back to the allocation question, right? That those smaller boats are perhaps not getting allocated enough quota, enough fishing rights to actually make a living. And so they're really struggling under this new catch shares regime. Paul Parker, the Cape Cod community, Cape Cod Fisheries Trust, is really designed to address this issue and create ways to make it financially viable for small boats. That's really what Chatham and the Cape has had traditionally. We don't even have those 100-foot boats for the most part. We really have the smaller boats in our fleet. So what are some of the programs that you have actually implemented to try to support and essentially incentivize these small boat ventures?
Well, again, I would take a quick step back to sort of, you know, what's relevant on the regional or national level versus what's relevant on the community level. And most of this conversation we've been having today is about groundfish. And for a port like Chatham, that's, you know, one small part of the puzzle. It used to be a really big part of the puzzle. 5 or 10 years ago, we would have said that we were a groundfish dependent port. But groundfish stocks have dried up around Chatham, and it's become a really smaller part of what we're able to harvest. As a result, we've had to build a community economic development strategy around a diversified approach to different fish stocks.
So now we're talking diversified, not in terms of the size of the boats, but diversity in terms of the fish that are being caught.
That's correct. And you know, in a port like Chatham, you can look out from the public viewing deck and you'll see a lot of boats that look the same until you look at the gear on the deck. And you'll see we have scallop boats, we have lobster boats, we have gillnet and hook boats, and they're all targeting different things between skates and dogfish and monkfish and tuna and striped bass. So it's a diversified portfolio. And that's one of the guiding principles of the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust, is restoring the resilience and stability to small businesses through maintaining a diversified portfolio of opportunities. If you're a sole source specialized ground fisherman in Chatham right now, the writing's on the wall. You just can't afford to be that specialized these days. And so we deploy a lot of strategies that we've seen work in things like agriculture to help fishermen build stronger businesses. Through our collaborator at the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust, we offer fishermen business planning and technical assistance that helps them to stabilize and grow their business in a new fishing economy, as well as think about how they can take advantage of different fisheries within the community. And so we actually have some revolving loan funds that can be utilized for those purposes.
Now, Vito Giacalone, the Northeast Seafood Coalition has under its umbrella the majority, actually, of the sectors that operate in the groundfish fishery in New England. How different are those sectors? How are they run differently, perhaps, when it's a small boat sector versus a large boat sector?
Essentially, they operate the same way. The issues that they're affecting fishermen right now are similar across the board. They're all small independent businesses. The size of their vessel may be different, or the type of gear that they deploy may be different, but essentially the structure of their businesses is the same. Therefore, what a sector manager deals with managing his members is very similar in a small boat sector as in a large. Now, economic viability across the board is really in question right now in the groundfish fishery, which is driving all of the problems that we see. It's driving the consolidation issue. It's driving the viability of these sectors to be able to stay independent as they have. Now, back when the coalition visioned that the fleet had to change to comply with the Magnuson Law, which was going to require annual catch limits or hard total allowable catches and go away from the DSC system to a directly accountable system, in order to comply with the law, we knew we had to go with something that could potentially, in a catch share system, result in massive consolidation and more of a corporate sort of interest in the resource allocations. When we set up the sectors, we set them up so that weak sectors, all small vessels, would be able to have their own governance structure, receive all of the same services and support as the larger strong sectors, and everyone contribute based on what they're catching into a common system which would provide those services back to them. So it was to give those smaller sectors and weaker ports who didn't fare as well in the initial allocation or whose resource near shore was not as catchable in later years as it was in previous years, is to give them an opportunity to not have to, you know, pack it in and either join up with a sector where they would be consumed or be in a situation where they felt they had to sell out and had no support network to lean on. Instead, this governance structure has worked. The key thing, though, the very first objective that, as far as a long-term objective for a fishery, and Brett mentioned it in the fleet visioning of 2006, is economic viability. That does not exist right now in the groundfish fishery. So until we're economically viable, we're not going to be able to restructure or do whatever we need to do to keep people in, because we literally have 100% of the participants in the fishery right now at threat of leaving the fishery. And it's all a direct result of two things. One, annual catch limits being reduced by as much as 90% all at once. I don't know any business that can sustain or remain economically viable with those types of reductions happening all at once. And we have what those of us have been around long enough. We have one of those down cycles in the catchability of groundfish. And we used to be more diversified and have a larger fleet that could move to smaller mesh fisheries or prosecute other fisheries. Now, as Paul said, it's become very specialized, and you have a very large percentage of the vessels in the Northeast now 100% dependent upon groundfish. And so when the resource turns down, it's always going to be a difficult time, and we're in that time right now. So, you know, we had a rally not too far back, and it was coined a perfect storm of bad circumstances, some of it within human control and some of it outside.
My guests this hour are Brett Tolley, community organizer and policy advocate with the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, Paul Parker, director of the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust, and Vito Giacalone, chair of governmental affairs for the Northeast Seafood Coalition. Before the break, Vito Giacalone, you were talking about this issue of financial viability within particularly the groundfish fishery and the fact that we're in this essentially crisis mode right now. Obviously, a major part of the financial viability of a fishery is the ability to go out and catch fish and to have the fish resource there to draw on. But the other half of that equation is having a market for that fish. And I think we've seen a real shift in recent years in how fish is marketed and a real rise in the importance of these community-supported fisheries and local markets for fish. Are local markets, Vito Giacalone, enough to sustain New England's fisheries?
Local markets at the, say, the CSF level, I think, are important to get more and more people. You start with small numbers, get more and more people to embrace and understand the positive aspects of buying local.
So the CSF is a community-supported fishery. It's like a CSA for farms, but for fish.
Precisely, like a CSA for farms. But that volume would not be able to support the fleet that's here now. What that would be is a seed, hopefully, for the larger buyers to want to participate in that type of product and that type of program, you know, and have more and more restaurants and seafood markets and even supermarkets start to embrace that. That traceability effort is still out there. It's in its infancy. But the reality is the processors and buyers who normally participated in buying New England groundfish and depended on New England groundfish have had to, in order to stay in business, have had to look for replacement products. And the reason for that is because of the fickleness and the volatility and the unreliability of the supply in New England groundfish, because when it seemed as though there was a lot of fish around and plenty of fish to catch, regulations and through the scientific recommendations would suddenly stop without warning, stop the supply. And this interruption was not something that most fish processors could sustain. So in order to keep their doors open, they've created relationships with foreign importers of the same type of species. And now a lot of our haddock and cod is coming in from Iceland and Norway and is being either previously frozen and thawed once or coming in fresh. And that's what's dominating the market right now. So that, you know, as we talk about fleet vision, as we talk about fleet diversity, as we talk about economic viability, we keep allowing this volatility in the allowable catches to basically make New England-produced groundfish no longer a major player on the real fish processor's menu. And that's our problem right now. Any volume that comes in seems to collapse the market, and it's not because they don't need our fish, that volume of fish, but because they've already committed to these importers. And so when our fish comes in, it's sort of, sure, we'll take it, but, you know, we're going to have to pay a small price for it because we really don't need it this week.
Paul Parker, the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance and the Fisheries Trust work extensively with Cape Cod fishermen on marketing plans, business plans. We do have the Cape Cod Fish Share here on the Cape, and I know that fishermen that are part of the alliance have pioneered all sorts of new markets for their fish, the live cod market being one, and trying to educate the public about things like redfish or dogfish, these alternative stocks that we could exploit perhaps more heavily than groundfish. Those are all things, though, that have as we've said before, come kind of bottom up and really at the local community level. Do you think that more attention to marketing, perhaps sustainability certification or any of these other initiatives are things that would benefit from a more regional approach, so more formal incorporation into council strategies?
When I think about local marketing, I think it's a really valuable part of what we do at the Alliance. And we support many of our members that are trying to work on initiatives such as dogfish marketing or skate, some of the species that they can catch. But at the end of the day, we have focused a lot of our resources on the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust, which is on the other side of a fisherman's balance sheet, which is helping them control costs. And just last year, the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust leased out 600,000 pounds of scallops and groundfish and surf clam to fishermen on Cape Cod. That supported 120 fishermen and their families and made an impact on the profitability of those businesses. I think we would view it as more challenging to try to manufacture those kinds of positive economic benefits to fishermen through marketing or distribution, even if it was scaled up to a regional project.
Now, Brett Tully, I know you view this issue of seafood production as a social justice issue. And obviously, the more we focus on local markets and community-based support for our fisheries, the more there becomes this issue of what about the people in the middle of the country that don't have a fishing community that they can support and draw on? So how do we address that issue? What should be the balance in your mind between a local and more of a long-distance market for our seafood?
Sure. Well, I want to say that, you know, in terms of looking at the entire country overall and our consumption of seafood, it's important to note in 2011, the Department of Commerce came out with a report that showed our entire fishing fleet throughout the states caught about 4 billion pounds of edible seafood. Now, the amount of seafood consumed that same year by folks in the United States was 91% imported seafood. Now, you might think that, well, maybe that was because our fishing fleet wasn't catching enough to feed people, but we had actually caught twice as much seafood as what was consumed in the United States. So, in short, we could have easily fed ourselves, but yet we import 91% of the seafood we eat in the United States.
And why is that? Is that a matter of which fish we choose to eat?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I think it's part of the marketing structures of what Vito was describing before. I think in general, we have a very powerful middle arena in the fishery where you can have a locally caught seafood right off the coast of Chatham, and it may travel 2,000 miles away. And we have fish that is being offered in Chatham at a seafood market that has come from 2,000 miles away, where there's no reason necessarily why the fish that was caught locally could have stayed locally. It, you know, could have the same nutritional value and taste and so forth. I think skate, monkfish, you know, there's a lot of good examples of fish that are being caught locally, that are seasonal, that could very well be in our local markets, yet they're not. So you ask why. And I think it's important to know that, you know, in this system where we have very heavy imports, there's a couple losers and there's winners in that scenario. The local fishermen are really losing out when it comes to the price that they're getting paid. And I think that the consumers are also losing out when it comes to the quality of the seafood and understanding where their seafood came from and having transparency. So I think, you know, having models like the CSF, allowing for farmers markets, and in terms of the question of how that relates to the folks in the middle of the country, we're seeing right now CSF's partner with communities and farming communities in the middle of the country to allow access so that they can participate in a CSF. The model is growing, it's dynamic, and we're seeing communities inland benefit from it as well.
Now, you just mentioned the middlemen, essentially, you call it the middle arena, that being, I guess, the processors, the auctions, the markets. Vito Giacalone, these businesses are also part of the Northeast Seafood Coalition. What is their role in creating and implementing a vision for New England's fisheries? It's not just the fishermen and the managers, right? These middlemen need to play a role as well.
Well, and historically, they don't play much of a role, only because they've got, you know, business at hand, and like I said, when volumes that they or a product that they ordinarily relied upon finally gets to the point where they're just not able to trust that the supply is going to come in sufficient quantities, they end up looking for a replacement product. So for the most part, the fish buyers, even though they're directly it's about as close to the fisherman as you can get as far as a business transaction. They're not really yet. There's a few of them that do get involved in policy, but for the most part, they haven't really engaged it very much. In the coalition, we have, you know, some of the auctions and some of the buyers involved, and they're somewhat involved as far as the board of directors and governance and weigh in, so that we at least are aware of what their problems are. But as I said, this is why we know that a lot of the major processes have shifted and are now relying on imported Icelandic and Norwegian fish when we're talking about New England groundfish.
Now, Brett Talley, your organization's fleet visioning process took place several years ago. We still don't have an official visioning process going on at the council level like the Mid-Atlantic did. Do you see a prospect for that happening? Is the idea of a regional vision for New England's fisheries gaining traction?
I think it is. You know, at NAMA, we've been doing our best to implement the elements of the vision that came out in 2006, both through working in the policy and then also working on the markets. And right now, on the policy level, we've been working with fishermen and fishing communities throughout New England to bring and elevate those voices on the council level. And in particular with the groundfish, there's been an amendment that's been prioritized by the New England managers for the past 3 years, an Amendment 18, which is also called the Fleet Diversity Amendment, which tasks managers to look at how they can better protect fleet diversity in New England and restrict excessive consolidation. And so it's in the works, and we're still engaging in that process. And what it's doing is forcing managers to really think long term and think of a vision.
Brett Tolley, community organizer and policy advocate with Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, Vito Giacalone, chair of governmental affairs for the Northeast Seafood Coalition, and Paul Parker, director of the Cape Cod Fisheries Trust. Thank you all for a lively discussion, and thanks all for listening. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.